Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an Iraq war widow shares her personal story of losing her husband in the war.
Before that, we're talking about some of the legislation being considered today in the State Assembly and in the Senate. There are some constitutional amendments up for a vote in the Assembly, and the Senate is voting on several bills, including one that would limit the power of circuit court judges.
Sean Johnson joins us from the state capitol now, where he has been covering the state legislature all day. He is the state government reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it is always good to find out what is happening in the Capitol. One of the big stories that we've been hearing a lot about ever since Governor Walker proposed it some time ago were these tax cuts. The state had that extra money lying about. Governor Walker proposed a series of tax cuts. What's been happening in the Assembly?
Yeah, well, they're going to pass a plan today that closely resembles what Governor Walker first introduced in his State of the State address. It's, you know, you can call this the Walker proposal almost. And it's largely a symbolic vote, though, because they still know that the Senate needs to make some changes to it. They haven't even referred it to the legislature's budget committee yet, the Joint Finance Committee. And so what you have here is Assembly Republicans. They want to take this clean, symbolic vote, put some pressure on the Senate, which is, you know, a little bit rare in the legislature. You don't often see this kind of infighting publicly between Republicans. And so, you know, from that sort of inside baseball perspective, it's interesting. But, you know, what they pass today is not going to be the final product.
As you said, the plan passed today closely resembles Governor Walker's plan. What were the changes?
If there's, you know, there's one change really that they added in the Assembly, and that's tax credit for construction. They've already talked about paring that back a bit. And you know, otherwise, the governor's plan is basically intact. It would be a $400 million property tax credit. That's sort of the centerpiece of the plan as far as Republicans are concerned. About a $100 million income tax credit that's targeted at the lowest bracket. $117 million deposit in the state's rainy day fund. Now, that's probably going to go away in the Senate version. And then, you know, overall, it would leave the state with a larger structural deficit. And again, that's a change that's probably going to go away in the Senate version.
But we'll have to wait and see how that turns out.
And I mean, that's sort of the cobbling together the votes in the Senate is going to be tougher just because they have a smaller margin over there.
Now, the State Assembly, as I understand it, also taking up a constitutional amendment that would change how taxes are raised in Wisconsin. What taxes are we talking about?
Yeah, that, I mean, if you're talking about an income tax or a sales tax increase, this would require a supermajority vote or a two-thirds vote. Could be a potentially big deal because, you know, usually when those taxes are raised, it's when stuff happens in a hurry. You know, when the economy goes into a recession, I think about Jim Doyle's last budget. He'd spent his first term talking about how the state taxes too much and sort of tried to develop this brand as a moderate Democrat, somebody who was against tax increases. And then here he found himself in a situation where, you know, the bottom was falling out and his budget included a number of tax increases. He wouldn't have been able to do that so easily under this plan because you would have required a two-thirds majority vote and they wouldn't have had it at the time. And so it's significant. But again, this is one of those where it might be a symbolic vote. You don't know where the Senate's at on this. It's a pretty, you know, pretty broad move. And, you know, the Senate might not be on board.
And forgive me for not knowing the answer to this, but has Governor Walker weighed in on that?
I have not heard the governor weigh in on that specific proposal. It'd be out of his hands because it's a constitutional amendment. It'd have to pass the legislature twice and then go before voters. It's interesting in that it would actually potentially tie his hands if he wants to do some big changes to the income and sales tax. You know, so for example, he sort of floated the idea of, in order to eliminate the income tax, potentially having an increase in the sales tax to offset that. his hands would be tied there. He couldn't do that without a two-thirds majority vote in the legislature. And so it would have consequences for, you know, governors of either party.
And speaking of constitutional amendments, there was another issue in the state assembly today, a proposal to eliminate the position of state treasurer. And there is a position that has been talked about for some time.
Yeah, the treasurer and the secretary of state, actually this plan was going to eliminate both of them, but it was amended down to just focus on the treasurer. And that's an office that just in this last state budget had its duties significantly pared down. The current officer, Kurt Schuller, actually campaigned on eliminating the office. He's not running again, so it's not exactly a tense situation there for Republicans. But again, this is one where I don't know what's going to happen in the state Senate. They said they haven't really met privately on this to discuss it. And, you know, they haven't caucused on it is the term that gets used. And so it might be another one of those symbolic votes we see today.
Now, over on the Senate side, a couple of things to talk about there as well. In fact, a vote today on establishing a Fox Cities Regional Transit Authority. First of all, what is the significance of that? And then how did that vote go?
Yeah, and this is one that I can tell you is definitely not going anywhere, but it would be very significant for the Fox Cities region. It would let them band together if they voted by referendum to create this Fox Cities Regional Transit Authority. Give them the power to levy a sales tax to support a bus system. That's a region that's going to potentially lose federal funding for its bus system because its population is growing. And so it's, you know, hugely significant for the region. And as a nod to that, you have the sponsors of the bill are Republican Senate President Mike Ellis and Democratic Assemblywoman Penny Bernard Schaber. Just a sign of, you know, how political this is. Those two are running against each other this November, and is no doubt part of the reason why Mike Ellis wanted to have a vote on this in the Senate. He got it. He got a bipartisan 25-7 vote in support of the bill, but Speaker Robin Voss says it's just not going anywhere in the Assembly.
And another bill in the Senate that, in the wake of Act 10 and some of the legislation that came out of that, there is a bill that would curb the power, as I understand it, of circuit court judges, a bill that's already received a significant amount of discussion. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and this version is way pared back compared to what you heard talked about last session when it was first introduced. That original version would have significantly limited the power of circuit court judges to block a state law. So when you think back to Act 10, it's been enjoined or blocked at the circuit court level a couple times, different facets of it, based on a county judge ruling. The bill that was introduced originally would have, you know, all but taken away the power of county judges to do that in lawsuits against the state. Clearly, they didn't have the votes for that in the state Senate because they pared it back dramatically. And the version that they passed today would actually just say that, you know, when there's a judgment against the state, you know, you have a right to an immediate appeal. I'm not sure exactly what the tangible effect of that would be, because we've seen some pretty quick appeals in some of these cases, and the Supreme Court can always grant an expedited appeal. So that's one where you saw this potential dramatic step that the Assembly was wanting to take. The Senate wasn't on board.
And so finally, to wrap up here, what bills should we be keeping our eyes on, bills that are actually going to advance, make it out of the legislature, and then wind up in Governor Walker's desk?
Well, I mean, that tax cut plan is going to, something's going to happen there. Republicans aren't going to go home without doing something with projected surplus. They could. I mean, they could leave it alone and say, we've got this to use in the next budget. But that's really going to be the story of the remainder of the session is what they do there. They're also debating what to do with some type of a school report card bill and a school accountability bill, whether you want to actually punish schools that perform badly by removing public funding. But that's one where, again, the two houses are not on the same page.
And this has to be wrapped up when?
And that's also a matter of contention, believe it or not. I mean, they're scheduled to be done, or they're scheduled to be in session through the first week of April. Speaker Robin Voss says he wants to be in maybe a couple days in early March and then be done. So that's a pretty unusual move. And, you know, it could be that Voss is trying to kind of dictate terms in negotiations with the Senate on all these outstanding issues.
Boy, lots of things to keep our eyes on. Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right, thanks, Gene.
That was Sean Johnson, state government reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, joining us today to talk about some of the legislation that lawmakers were voting on today at the state capitol. The United States has been at war since October of 2001, and as of the end of last year, over 4,600 soldiers have died in Iraq and Afghanistan.
One aspect that can get overlooked during wartime is who's left behind when a soldier dies. In military parlance, women who lose their husbands are called unremarried widows. Artis Henderson's husband died in a helicopter crash in the Iraq War in 2006, only 6 months after their marriage. Artis is a journalist and a writer, which allows her to articulate her loss and share it with the world, which she does in her new memoir, Unremarried Widow. Artis, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before he was deployed, your husband had a dream that scared you. He dreamed of his own death. And that must be something that's always playing in the background in the minds of military families. How much weight did the two of you put on that dream when your husband had it?
I think when he first had the dream, we were both frightened. It felt like a premonition. But I think that military families are very good at sort of separating our worries about the future and daily life. Otherwise, it's too weighty.
And what did he dream?
He dreamt that he died in a helicopter crash, which he did, and he dreamt that he was with the co-pilot that he actually died with.
So he had what turned out to be a direct premonition of his death that morning.
Yes, that's right.
And your husband deployed only 3 months after your marriage, and the two of you were, from the looks of it and from your book, incredibly in love. I saw a picture of the two of you taken the day before he deployed, and it's a beautiful picture. Is that how you felt on that day, that you were incredibly in love and having to let go of someone that you couldn't bear to let go of at that time?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I couldn't. You know, when he went away to training, we said we couldn't imagine being apart for 3 weeks. And then when he deployed, we couldn't imagine being apart for a year. And now.
Did you ever think, you know, maybe this isn't the right thing for us? It's so hard for us to be apart. Did you ever weigh the balance of being in the military?
I don't know. You know, we hadn't gotten to that point. When I met him, he was already in the military. And he still had about 5 years left on his commitment. So we did. We talked about the future a lot, but we had a long haul until he was done.
Yeah. Well, you'd always had a vision of your life as a writer living abroad. You thought about being freewheeling, and you had lived in Paris for a while already. But you chose to marry a military man to be part of this circle of military wives. How did you, in that beginning time, how did you make peace with these dreams you'd had of what your life would be and what your life actually was when you were married?
That was something I struggled with almost every day. And I'm not sure that my time with Miles, I ever made peace with it. It was something I was trying to sort out, how to live my own life and still be part of this military community. It's very difficult. There are a lot of sacrifices for military spouses.
What kind of sacrifices?
Well, we're very much tied to our partners, and the military decides which, you know, for the most part, which base you'll go to and how long you'll spend there. And as a spouse, your choice is to follow or to stay in one place. And those are kind of the two choices.
And how did you fit in with the community of military wives on these bases where you lived?
I think initially I had a hard time fitting in. I was younger. At first, we weren't married, and so when you're not married in the military, you have no status, of course. So I was somewhat on the outside. I didn't have children, and then also I had these plans of traveling and kind of living my own life, and that maybe didn't fit in so well with that community.
Did you reach a point where you felt like you understood why they were close-knit and you were part of them? Did you get to that point?
Yes. And now I 100% see that. It's unfortunate that it took losing Miles to see that, because once he was gone, once I lost him and he died, the military community really rallied around me. And I'm so very close to both military widows and the military wives from his unit.
What do you remember about the day that you learned your husband wasn't coming back from Iraq? Did it feel different than other days?
In hindsight, I can see, yes, it was so different. At the time, something felt wrong, but I didn't know enough to say what it was. And then later, I can see how the whole day felt dark.
We see that moment in movies, on TV, quite a lot, when the wife or the partner gets the news that her spouse, her partner, has fallen in war, that they're not coming back. But what does that moment actually feel like when it happens?
It feels like nothing you imagine. You know, I think as a military spouse, as a military wife, you imagine it, you think about it a lot, what it might look like if it happens. And when it happened, it looked nothing like I had foreseen. And it felt, I can't even describe how awful it felt.
The two soldiers who told you, they were in your home when you came in, right?
Yes, I was living with my mom when he deployed, so my mom had already come home from work, so she had let them in. So by the time I came home, they were in the house.
You use a phrase at one point that is apparently a military phrase. It's called right of the boom. It's what happens after a catastrophic event. It sounds like a loss of life. And it also sounds like it describes the protocols of what happens after a death. So what happened after that big moment, after that boom that hit you and your husband?
Yes. So right after, so the soldiers are there, the chaplain, and then the other one who's not a chaplain, and you can ask them to stay, but I didn't. And so they left, and then kind of this hole in my life opened up. And then there's certain procedures you have to go through. His things came home from Iraq. There was an official military briefing where I learned the cause of his death. I guess that's the sort of, I had to get a new military ID with my new status on it.
And you also learned that the pilot who died with your husband, Miles, was the same pilot that he dreamed about crashing with.
Yes. It's unbelievable.
How did becoming a widow yourself change your relationship with your mother? You were living with her. What happened with the two of you?
It's been incredible, my relationship with my mom, because my father died when I was 5, and my mom never remarried. And growing up, I never really understood why she handled my father's death the way she did. And then after Miles died, I found myself doing exactly the same thing she had done. And I think for the first time in my life, I understood why she had lived how she lived. And so I think we were close before, but I think we are even closer now.
When we read about the stages of grief, something you come across is that you don't get over a death or a loss like that, that you just sort of learn to carry it. How have you learned to carry it since Miles died?
It has been a long learning process. I've done the things that people do. I was in a grief group. I'm friends with other widows. And I think that writing this book in a lot of ways helped me learn to carry it.
Is there a message for other Army widows or widowers that you'd like to share as a writer and as someone who's been through this?
I think that grieving in general, and especially after a military death, is so lonely. I think that we find ourselves just so alone, and I just want them to know that someone else is hurting like they're hurting.
And have you heard from people who've said, "Artist, thank you for writing this. I don't feel as alone as I did."
I have. People have been so generous about this book.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today. I know it's painful, but it's a beautiful book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Ardis Henderson, a journalist and the author of Unremarried Widow. In the book, she tells the story of her husband's death in the Iraq War in 2006 and how she rebuilt her life afterwards.
In the last decade, there has been a rise in single-sex classrooms in the United States. According to the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education, there were only about a dozen public schools that offered single-gender classrooms in 2002. But by the 2011-12 school year, at least 506 public schools in the United States offered single-sex educational opportunities.
With such an increase, there's been talk about the effectiveness of this educational strategy. Now a new major study out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison says there's actually little evidence that these classrooms offer any educational or social benefits.
Joining us now in the studio is Janet Hyde. She is a professor of psychology at the UW-Madison, and she is one of the authors of the study. Janet, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
I want to talk a little bit about the background of single-sex education to kind of give us some context for all of this. As I understand it, single-sex education wasn't a very big deal, but then 2006, No Child Left Behind, some changes in Title IX kind of changed the landscape out there and led to a rise in single-sex classrooms. Is that correct, more or less?
Yes, that's right. Title IX, dating from the early 1970s, basically made gender segregation in the schools, in the public schools, illegal with certain exceptions like physical education. And then in 2006, during the George W. Bush administration, they did issue guidelines that permitted some single-sex classes within coeducational public schools if there was a compelling educational interest that would be served by those single-sex classes. And that, of course, is the catch. Is there a compelling educational interest? Is there a compelling educational benefit to students?
And the compelling educational interest, I says, a lot of the folks who back single-sex education say things like boys tend to dominate in the classroom, and so if you separate them, that's better. And by separating out girls, you could allow them more opportunities to succeed in math and science and so forth. And that really is kind of the heart of your study, as I understand it, to find out if some of those claims really lived up to the hype.
Right, exactly. There are several gurus who go around the country hiring themselves out for large consulting fees to school districts to train teachers in their methods of single-sex schooling. And they do have the kinds of claims that you've stated. And so we wanted to gather the best available scientific evidence to see whether those claims are true and whether school districts are advised to adopt single-sex classrooms.
So let's talk about the study. When did it start? Where did you get the data from?
Well, we used a statistical technique called meta-analysis. And when you do that, you collect all available data on a particular question. In this case, we were able to locate 184 studies that tested kids in single-sex compared with coeducational schooling. That represents the testing of about 1.6 million students. So this is very definitive. We then applied statistical analyses to put together all of their results across a wide array of outcomes, including math performance, math attitude, self-esteem, and so on, and then reached the conclusions that we did reach, which is that there don't seem to be any benefits to single-sex schooling.
And as I understand the study, it breaks that conclusion up into two basic areas, sort of the educational side of things and then the social side of things. So let's start with the educational benefits or the findings that the study showed up in terms of educational benefits. The claims were that it would help improve educational performance. What did the study find?
Right. We had multiple measures of educational performance. We had math performance, science performance, verbal performance, as well as attitudes in those areas. And we didn't find any advantages to kids in single-sex schooling for any of those for either girls or boys.
So none.
No advantages.
I got to ask you, were you surprised by that? I mean, going into a study like this, you must have had a hypothesis that something was going to change somewhere, but
Well, one of the things we did in this study, there actually are a lot of very poor studies out there on single-sex schooling, and there's some excellent ones. Mm-hmm. The thing that differentiates between these two, and when I gave you the results, I was talking about the good studies.
Sure.
The poor studies often will compare kids in single-sex and co-ed schools that aren't equivalent. For example, there are lots of single-sex schools that are very elite. The kids come from families with money and education, and they compare it to some random co-ed school. The single best predictors of kids' educational performance is their parents' education and income. So it's not a fair comparison to take kids from a privileged school and those with an average school. So those are the poor quality studies, and sometimes they do find benefits to single sex. The better studies controlled for these pre-existing differences or did the best thing, which is randomly assign kids either to single sex or co-educational classes. That's when you've got a real experiment and you can really see what's going on. And those good quality studies are the ones that find no benefits to single-sex schooling.
And that we were talking about educational achievement there. What about that social side of things? You know, that boys might have an advantage in a co-ed situation. What did your study show there?
Well, we didn't look at studies that did things like the number of times teachers called on kids in mm-hmm. the classroom, for example. We just looked at kids' performance as you would measure it on paper and pencil test. But we did, for example, look at self-esteem. It's been claimed that girls will have better self-esteem in single-sex schools. We found no evidence for that. There was no benefit to single-sex.
All right, we're talking with UW psychologist Janet Hyde right now about her recent study on single-sex classrooms. The study shows no educational or social benefits to dividing classes by gender, and we'd like to hear from you on this. There's been a lot of talk, of course, here in Wisconsin about single-sex classrooms and the advantages or disadvantages of them. What do you make of it? What do you make of this study and its findings? Is this something that you might want for your child? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking with UW psychologist Janet Hyde right now about her recent study on single-sex classrooms, which shows no educational or social benefits to dividing classes by gender. And we'd like to hear from you. What do you make of this idea behind single-sex classrooms? Do you have any personal experiences with this kind of education? Give us a call if you'd like to join in at 800-642-1234. You can also join in by email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Janet Hyde, before the break, we were talking about the results of the study, and not so good if you're a proponent of a single-sex education. So take us back, if you would, and maybe give us some of the reasons why schools would have been interested in going down this road in the first place.
Right. I mean, that's a good question. Part of it is that we feel that there's such a crisis in American education. American kids don't score well compared with their peers in other nations in some of these international testing programs. People are also worried about a crisis, for example, for ethnic minority kids. So when you're in this crisis mode and somebody says, I'll solve that problem. We'll just put the boys in one room and the girls in another room. You say, sure, we'll try that. So I think it's this crisis mentality. Part of the problem, though, is that that doesn't allow us to look at what the actual deeper causes are of this poor performance. There are some things that would really contribute to improving performance, but single-sex schooling is not one of them.
And here in Wisconsin, what has it looked like? How many school districts have gotten involved?
I don't know that I have an exact count. I believe that there are about 6 or 7 school districts that have instituted these programs. Some have quietly dropped them. Janesville, for example, had single-sex classes in their middle school. They dropped it. La Crosse dropped it. Beloit is the school district that is continuing these single-sex classrooms.
So as you look at the results of the study, are there any areas that you would like to study further, any demographic challenges that maybe weren't addressed by the study?
Yeah, one in particular. Claims have been made that the single-sex schools are particularly good for ethnic minority boys, especially African-American boys. And people say there's a state of crisis for them, although I'm not sure that it's a crisis compared to African-American girls, who I think also need attention. But the claim has been made that African-American boys will do especially well in single-sex schooling. We weren't able to find enough high-quality studies to make a conclusion one way or the other. So there's no demonstrated benefit, but we could stand to have some good studies of that question.
And I have to ask, so you didn't find any particular benefits. Did the study find any downsides, or is the lack of a benefit a downside?
Well, the lack of a benefit's a downside when it's very costly and cumbersome to institute single-sex classrooms in a public school, because the law says that if you're going to have, for example, a ninth grade algebra class and offer a boys class and a girls class, you also have to offer a co-ed class, because parents and students have a right to choice of what they're going to have. So that means that you have to have three identical algebra classes, and that's not feasible in a lot of school districts. It's unwieldy, it creates scheduling problems, and so on. So there's a cost, not to mention the cost of hiring these consultants to train the teachers. So it's been costly. And that means that if there's no benefit, it is a cost. The other issue, of course, is that it creates segregation. And in the United States, we frown on segregation. We don't like racial segregation. We shouldn't like gender segregation either. And it has some probably very negative consequences, such as gender stereotyping. So those are costs to it.
Let's go to the listeners right now. And if you'd like to join in, by the way, here's our phone number. It is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Matt joins us from Middleton right now. Hi, Matt.
Hello. Actually, I decided to change my question after listening to the guest. My original one was to ask if there was a correlation with teen pregnancies and co-ed or non-co-ed. But actually, the question I'm more interested in after listening to you is if you accounted for that economic disparity you just discussed. For instance, if the schools are dividing their resources, trying to duplicate their classrooms, could that have an effect on the results? And I'll take my answer up here. Thank you.
Okay, that's a very good question. The economic disparities that we addressed in the study were if they controlled for economic advantage in single-sex schools that the parents, the families might have compared with co-ed schools. We didn't do an analysis, it just wasn't part of the scope of this study, of what it's costing schools to institute single-sex programs. I think I would love to see someone do that analysis. I think it'd be tough to do because I'm not sure schools would release their records, although they're public schools and you would think there would be public accountability. But it's a very interesting question.
And a very complicated one.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's part of the trick to all this. As you talk about the complications of economic factors and educational achievement and all of that, it sort of goes back to what you started with in terms of people are looking for an answer, and this one appears to be an attractive one.
Right. It's a simple solution. We'll put the boys in one room and the girls in the other. What we really know helps to improve achievement and close achievement gaps are things like four-year-old kindergarten. We really ought to have that everywhere. The longer you leave kids out in preschools where well-to-do parents can buy good preschool care and poor parents can't, that just widens achievement gaps. There's a gap by the time kids enter kindergarten. So you want to have four-year-old kindergarten. That costs school districts something, but I think it's a much better investment of money than single-sex classrooms. We also need to expand to a 10 or 11-month school year. Kids from low-income families have a meltdown over the summer. They actually call it meltdown. They forget what they learned 3 months ago. So we really need to keep kids in school longer. Once again, that'll cost more. We'll have to pay teachers more. But those are good places to invest our funds.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Deborah joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Deborah.
You know, boys and girls together in a classroom, in a school building at that age, it becomes more of a social issue than an educational issue for them. So I wonder, you know, and I think that is attributed to bullying. And you know, if you really break it down, I think, you know, the competition of boys around. Have you studied the aspect of singling out single sex schools to bullying, the bullying issue?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, too. And one of the things I try to stress with this is the difference between anecdotes and systematic scientific and information. And we've tried to provide the latter. There are lots of anecdotes about how girls, for example, get bullied by boys. If you look at studies of bullying, most bullying is actually same-sex bullying. That is, it's boys bullying boys, and sometimes girls bullying girls, although not as much as boys bullying boys. So single-sex classrooms are certainly not the way to end bullying, because most of it is same-sex.
Tom joins us now from B-Town. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi. I went to a single-sex high school in the 60s, and I find that single-sex certainly kept us from thinking about the problems of puberty and giving our attention strictly to education and to sports. But I don't think that having single-sex classrooms in a co-ed situation is considered single-sex. You still have the interaction at lunchtime, you still have the interaction at break time between classes, and that takes away from the concept of having one sex going through the educational process. I don't know if you've done a study other than assuming that most single-sex schools are for the upper class, the wealthy. Back in the 60s, we had single-sex schools. Of course, they were religious schools. So it was Catholic. With all income brackets, and we thought the education was a lot better than having, co-ed schooling.
Tom, thanks so much for the call. Janet, a couple of things there. What about that idea of interaction between classes and so forth?
Well, this caller is interested in single-sex schools, complete schools, mm-hmm. as opposed to classrooms. And once again, I want to emphasize the difference between anecdotes and systematic scientific information. So some people who went to single-sex schools say, wow, it was a great education. I can tell you I went to coeducational schools the whole time, and I thought it was a great education. So we can trade anecdotes, but what we need is systematic scientific information, and that's what this study provides, and it just shows no benefits. Single-sex schools do tout that characteristic, and they make the students believe it, but it doesn't hold up to the scrutiny of science.
So as you talk to policymakers, to legislators, to school board members, to parents, you know, who might be interested in this topic, two questions here. What do you hope that they'll take away from this study? And the second thing is, how do they react to it? Because a lot of people have a lot of emotional investment on one side or the other of this issue.
Well, right. I just hope that parents and also school districts will take the science to heart. We like science-based education rather than anecdotal-based education. And I know that people have strong feelings, and we just have to get past the anecdotes, I guess I'll have to say.
All right. Well, that's a great place to leave it. Janet, thanks so much for being here today. Janet Hyde is a professor of psychology at UW-Madison and an author of the study on single-sex classrooms that we've just been talking about.